Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies, we'll reach in there, we'll pull the baby out, clip the cord, but not in a creepy way.
Oh no. That's creepy just hearing it.
Awkward.
Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1964 Stanley Kubrick, my favorite director, directed Dr. Strangelove. There's a longer title, but I didn't write it down in my notes, and I don't care to read the whole thing, unless you wish.
How I learned to stop worrying and love the bomb.
Which is a great, great movie. If you haven't seen it, rush out now, watch the movie, then come back to us.
I had forgotten how great this movie was. I think I texted you that this is a nearly flawless movie.
Oh, I definitely think so.
And I had forgotten how good it was.
And it's way over the top, but it's also pretty subtle and pretty spot on as far as the satire.
It really is one of the best movies out there, even still. And I love that it's in black and white, and I love, you know, I know that you love it in spite of it being a Kubrick flick.
Oh yeah, no, it's fine. There is
no 2001.
No, because it moves along. It's got lots of action throughout the whole thing. They're not these long, ponderous shots and then wacky, unfulfilled endings. You know how this movie begins and you know how this movie ends, and I appreciate that. Any housekeeping before we start digging into the movie?
What was the last review you and Drew had out?
No, I think the last one was you and me, Kingpin.
Yeah, I was listening to that, but I was also listening to the one right before that, which was you and Drew, and I don't remember which movie that was.
Oh, Man on Fire.
Yeah, I think that's what I just listened to.
Yeah, had you seen Man on Fire?
I have not, and I couldn't find it, so I didn't watch it. So I ended up listening to the podcast anyway. But
oh, that's fine.
I thought it was, you and Drew, I thought it was very good. So, you know, it was interesting to hear, you know, all the things that they could have put in the movie that they didn't, i.e. the alternate bomb plot, which made me laugh out loud. So, yeah, in the butt, Bob.
But I don't know. It would have been a different movie. It would have been, I guess it would have been fine, actually. As Drew pointed out, it was just an action movie. It wasn't, I don't think it was aiming for anything higher than that. Unlike this movie, which is high art.
This movie is social commentary, comedy, and kind of a little bit of a horror thrown in, which even today is still hilarious and biting and somewhat not entirely out of, you know, not entirely out of the worldview.
Okay, I'm going to, at the risk of offending Travis, I want to ask you first, before we even start talking about Dr. Strangelove in any detail, have you seen the movie? Have you seen either the, I think there may have been a movie, Failsafe, at roughly the same time. I know the book came out at the same time as Dr. Strangelove, but there was a remake, a TV remake that they did live on TV. And
a Failsafe?
Yes.
Okay, I have not seen Failsafe, but I have a whole bunch of notes on Failsafe from the added bonus features to talk about when we're done talking about the movie. Unless you want to talk about it now.
Oh, no, we can talk about it later. That's fine. I just wondered if you had seen it, because I had actually seen it relatively recently.
I haven't seen it. It's on my list now, because now I'm interested to go watch it.
Because it is the serious version of this comedy film.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the exact same plot.
Yeah, no, we'll talk about it.
Okay, that's fine, when we get there.
We'll talk about it when we get to the special, when we get to all the added stuff, so.
Okay. Well, Lyd, you want to just dive into the plot then?
Yeah, I love the opening of this movie. Kubrick, he wanted something that was, the opening, he wanted, like, what's the most raunchy sexual thing you can think of that's not dirty that we can show that relates to this movie? And of course, the opening is the two planes having sex in midair.
Oh, yeah. It is totally, completely a sex show with two airplanes.
Yeah. And so all the text, because I originally wrote, oh, the stick writing for text opening is pretty cool. But then I wrote, how low budget was this movie? But then I kind of find out that Kubrick just liked it. It looked great because it didn't detract. You know, as an artist, he was able to put the text in that fit over and didn't detract from what was already on the screen, but kind of fit around all the corners and edges, and, you know, it just fit around whatever he was, the imagery was on the screen at the moment. And also, by the way, if you watch closely, there's a typo because he misspelled a word.
Which word was that?
Based. He left the D off of based, based on the novel. It was based on the novel, which is funny. Cause, you know, it was handwritten. So, of course, you know, nobody's really proofing it.
Well, and let me just point out, this is the kind of artistry and fiddly bits that I can get behind.
Oh, absolutely.
This is not cinematic masturbation. This is actually doing something innovative and having it work out.
And it could have very easily been some bad, cheesy opening, but it wasn't. The music and the imagery and the text over it were, I mean, it was, like I said, aside from the typo, flawless. I mean, it really was, it gave you all the information that you needed. It was entertaining. It didn't seem long. And yet, I loved watching the differences in the text and how, you know, kind of they were stacked and moved and the kind of picturesque. And I thought it was cool. So.
Oh, it was absolutely cool. And again, you don't quite know what you're getting into when you start this movie.
Right.
You know, you're getting in, I mean, you get, have the long shots of the plane and it's all very like ballet type thing. Except that it's totally raunchy because it is, you know, I mean, if there's just a giant penis hanging out of the back of an airplane, which is just hysterical.
No, it really is. I mean, it really does kind of speak to the genius of Stanley Kubrick, though.
Oh, yeah. It's good stuff. And that's just the first minute of the movie.
Yeah, well, except that you have to admire the fact that at least my copy, had this huge disclaimer of an opening. They had to put a big disclaimer that, like, you know, any similarity between characters real and living is purely coincidental.
Well, and because this is actually in the middle of the Cold War. Now, is Kubrick an Englishman?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But he did a lot of filming in England. And certainly Peter Sellers is English. But really, by making fun of the Soviet prime minister, I mean, you know, that could have caused extra tension. And as it turns out, historically, this was, you know, this is a particularly tenuous time in American history in the Cold War.
Yeah, no, and you know, unfortunately, you could easily understand how this may not have been entirely off the mark. I mean, I wrote at one point, I'm like, it makes you wonder how in that day and age, how difficult that whole thing would have been to enact as a, you know, as a kind of a runaway general or runaway, you know, soldier. I can imagine, at least in my mind's eye, how easily this could have happened. And while it's satire and it's hilarity, like, it has a little bit of like, ha ha ha, what could have happened. Now, in today's day and age, I also had to have, you know, I juxtaposed that in my head. I'm like, with Twitter and, you know, text messaging and, you know, instant news media, you know, how possible would it be to be one base commander to close a base and control everything down to that, you know, that point. So it's an interesting thought to ponder.
Well, as we talked about Wag the Dog, though, would we even get the true story?
And that's the other point. Just FYI, Stanley Kubrick was born in the Bronx.
Oh, okay. So never mind.
He did die in England.
Yeah, well, it's probably the food. Anyway, sorry. That was cheap. Cheap, but true. So, shall we dive into the plot?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think one of the greatest things about the opening of this movie is, you know, the flight crew and the opening of the safe, and his hat is in the safe.
Oh, yeah. Well, and let's talk about the cast. I guess, well, let me set the stage just for a second, then we'll talk about the cast. The movie starts out with United States Air Force Brigadier General Jack D. Ripper. The names in this movie are not subtle, and that makes for fun. I mean, and they get less subtle as the movie goes along, because by the time we get to Keenan Wynn, Bat Guano.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We've lost all subtlety and we're just going straight for the joke. But okay, it starts with General Jack D. Ripper, who is commander of Burpleson Air Force Base, which houses the SAC 843rd bomb wing equipped with B-52 bombers. And the 843rd is currently on airborne alert, in flight just hours from the Soviet border. And it explains that during this time,
in order to guard against surprise nuclear attack, America's Strategic Air Command maintains a large force of B-52 bombers airborne 24 hours a day. Each B-52 can deliver a nuclear bomb load of 50 megatons, equal to 16 times the total explosive force of all the bombs and shells used by all the armies in World War II. Based in America, the Airborne Alert Force is deployed from the Persian Gulf to the Arctic Ocean, but they have one geographical factor in common. They are all 2 hours from their targets inside Russia.
And they were patrolling the area just so that if they got a call to go and lay waste to their targets, they would. Because they're carrying nuclear missiles.
Well done.
See what I did there? So Ripper, General Ripper, orders his executive officer, Group Captain Lionel Mandrake of the Royal Air Force, to put the base on alert, asserting that it's not a drill, and he orders him to issue Wing Attack Plan R to the patrolling aircraft, including one commanded by Major T.J. King Kong. All of the aircraft commence an attack flight on Russia and allow communications only through the CRM-114 discriminator. Now, so at this point, we have, again, a very sort of neat setup. We have a general who, I think right from the get-go, we know, is just acting on his own accord. Because he's nuts to begin with.
Yeah.
By the way, if there's a pun in Lionel Mandrake, the name itself, I don't know what it is.
I don't get it either, but my problem was I kept hearing Inspector Sidney Wang.
Of course. Peter Sellers was, by the way, Peter Sellers is Lionel Mandrake. Peter Sellers was supposed to play 4 parts in this movie, but he ended up spraining his ankle and calling to play 3. He was actually supposed to play Major King Kong as well.
Yes, he actually broke his leg. He was on the bomb in the bomb bay, and he and Kubrick were arguing, and he fell from the bomb and fell 15 feet and broke his leg.
Oh, okay. That's pretty serious.
And so they were like, well, there's no way you could crawl in and out of the cockpit up and down and do all the things you need to do, you know, that we need to shoot. So we're going to have to call and get somebody else. And, you know, that's part of the reason that Dr. Strangelove ended up in the wheelchair.
Oh, I did not know that. That's funny.
So when they put out the casting for, you know, the commander for King Kong, they cast Slim Pickens, and when he showed up, they're like, wow, that guy shows up in character, not realizing that he wasn't in character. That's really how he was.
Yeah, it was just hilarious. By the way, also part of the flight crew is a very young James Earl Jones.
Absolutely.
It's just great to see a young and relatively thin James Earl Jones.
Oh, yeah, no, he looks like almost like a teenager, and like he needs to eat something.
Oh, absolutely. Turns out he did, though, so it's all worked out for him. We spent a lot of time initially with Mandrake because he's such, you know, Peter Sellers is just such a charismatic, compelling figure on the screen. And even though Ripper is a lunatic and plays it really well, it's hard to upstage Peter Sellers in any sense.
Well, and in the features of the film, they say that a lot of the most of the dialogue for Peter Sellers' characters in this movie, none of the dialogue was really written. The script was kind of loosely written, but most of what he did was ad-libbed, which was great, except that they would cut up constantly.
Oh, here, you saw all the extras, and I did not. I've just seen the movie several times. And how much fighting was there? Because I know George C. Scott did some fighting with Kubrick.
Well, and so apparently Kubrick knew that George C. Scott was going to be difficult, and so what he did to mitigate it was he knew George C. Scott was a chess player, and he would put a chessboard out constantly and just challenge George C. Scott and taunt him mercilessly. And so they would play games anytime George C. Scott started to get idle and get antsy. And the thing was, is that it was clear that Stanley was just effing with them, because George C. Scott would sit for like, you know, almost an hour and make a move, and Kubrick would spend like 30 seconds and make a move and win the game. And so Kubrick was just toying with him, just to taunt him, but it spurned George C. Scott on enough that he kept wanting to try and beat Kubrick. And occasionally he won, but, you know, it took him some time. So, but yeah, no, there was some tension.
Well, it all worked out, because that's the thing is, this movie is full of strong characters. You have Mandrake, who's understated as far as he's more of an English character, where he's like, are you really telling me to do what I think you're telling me to do? And don't you think this is maybe you're going maybe a little too far, you know, because Mandrake gets the idea right away that there is no order to go to war.
Right.
So he tries to stop Ripper, but Ripper locks them both in his office. And then Ripper gives him the speech.
Mandrake, do you recall what Clemenceau once said about war?
No, I didn't think I knew that, yeah.
He said war was too important to be left to the generals. When he said that, 50 years ago, he might have been right. But today, war is too important to be left to politicians. They have neither the time, the training, nor the inclination for strategic thought. I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Which I was like, oh boy, you could be easily in Portland.
Well, it's so funny because it's such an odd, specific phrase. He keeps using the precious bodily fluids.
That it's almost uncomfortable.
Oh yeah, and you know, he is just, from the minute he says that, you know, this guy is off his rocker. And when he describes his actual orders to his base, he's like, oh yeah, the base is on red alert. He confiscated all the radios. I was thinking, how do you know you have to register your privately owned radios? Like, if you have a transistor radio, the government knows about it if you're in an Air Force base?
I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. It's crazy. So,
or he ran such a tight ship that he wanted, you know, he was planning for the propaganda from the Reds.
Well, yeah, and he said, basically, don't trust anybody. If you don't know, it doesn't matter what uniform they wear, if you don't know them personally, they are an enemy to you.
Which is brilliant.
It's the same thing with the aircraft wing. You know, they have, the only communications they can get, they turn off their radio except for this one particular, like, scramble unit, this CRM-114, and if they don't get any transmissions on that, they're going to go ahead and, you know, cause World War III. And actually, Flight Plan R is actually a counterattack. Everybody on the airplane believes that one or more major U.S. cities have been hit by the atomic bomb.
Yeah, because the whole plan is that the Plan R assumes that there's nobody left in Washington to give the order.
Exactly. We are under the theory of mutually assured destruction, which, you know, was a part of our lives growing up. I mean, we just took it for granted that if they fired on us, we were going to fire on them with everything we had.
Right.
Because we were all going to die. So that kept everybody from firing anything.
Hopefully.
It happened to. But
so far.
So far, yes. Yeah, how funny that things go in cycles.
Yeah, since the Ukraine is so secure, and I'm sure all of the nuclear weapons in the former Soviet Union are just absolutely guarded and under lock and key.
Well, and again, terrorism changes everything.
Yeah. One thing. So when in the initial beginning they're locked in the Ripper's office, there are some great camera angles.
Oh, most definitely.
So, you know, looking up at Ripper from lower on the desk is just fantastic. And some of the shading and the the lighting was just, I actually paused it at one point because I'm like, that is a great shot. You don't see great shots as often, but that was clearly a well thought out screen view.
It adds to his unhingedness.
Yeah,
because he's at first slightly sweaty. He becomes more sweaty as it goes along, and the whole thing, it sets the stage for who these characters are, and it adds to what they are doing.
Right, and you know, and Kubrick actually convinced the actor who played Ripper to come out of retirement for this role. He's like, "You've got to do it." And finally, he agreed, and I'm glad he did, because I can't imagine who else they would have had do this part.
No, he was great. And so now we've been introduced to two sets. Now we go to the third set in this movie. This is really just a three-set movie. We've got aboard the plane. We have Ripper's office, pretty much, and the base to a smaller extent. But basically, it's just in the office for the most part. And then you have the third set, which is the war room. Well, I guess you start out with General Buck Turgidson, who is George C. Scott in a fantastic role.
Absolutely.
When he gets called, he's in the middle of, beginning a night of lovemaking with his, it turns out, Playboy model girlfriend. Also his secretary, too. But she was the girl, she's the same woman, she was the same woman who was in the Playboy that the guys in the plane were looking at.
Yes.
And so he gets called.
The only female in the movie, by the way.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So he gets called at 3 a.m. to the war room. And he's just, he is hamming it up. And he does such a good job. I mean, the combination of his face, you know, his like eagle nose, you know, Roman nose with that haircut.
Mm-hmm.
And then the uniform. Oh, it's just.
And the squinting, the sideways kind of squinting like, huh?
Oh, and the gum chewing. The amount of gum chewing he does in this movie is incredible.
I really think this is, I love George C. Scott, but this role, he really was perfect. His delivery was so deadpan at points, but so drop-dead hilarious at other points.
Well, and that's what makes this all work. Everybody played this total farce as straight as possible. You know, there's some characters, for instance, also in the war room, we have the President of the United States, President Merkin Muffley. And I assume you get that joke on his name. A Merkin. No. A Merkin is like something you put over an actress usually to cover her vagina.
I had no idea.
Yes. So Merkin Muffley, it's a vagina joke. And of course Buck Turgidson is a penis joke, so it all works out.
Yeah, no, I got that one.
So we have President Merkin Muffley, who's something of a, you know, he's a diplomat. So he's a little less manly than all the generals in the room, and certainly is not interested in having a nuclear war.
Now, General Turgidson, what's going on here?
Mr. President, about 35 minutes ago, General Jack Ripper, the commanding general of Burpleson Air Force Base, issued an order to the 34 B-52s of his wing, which were airborne at the time, as part of a special exercise we were holding called Operation Dropkick. Now, it appears that the order called for the planes to attack their targets inside Russia. The planes are fully armed with nuclear weapons with an average load of 40 megatons each. Now, the central display of Russia will indicate the position of the planes. The triangles are their primary targets. The squares are their secondary targets. The aircraft will begin penetrating Russian radar cover within 25 minutes.
General Turgidson, I find this very difficult to understand. I was under the impression that I was the only one in authority to order the use of nuclear weapons.
That's right, sir. You are the only person authorized to do so. And although I hate to judge before all the facts are in, it's beginning to look like General Ripper exceeded his authority.
It certainly does. Far beyond the point I would have imagined possible.
Well, perhaps you're forgetting the provisions of Plan R, sir.
Plan R?
Plan R is an emergency war plan in which a lower echelon commander may order nuclear retaliation after a sneak attack if the normal chain of command has been disrupted. You approved it, sir, you must remember. Surely you must recall, sir, when Senator Buford made that big hassle about our deterrent lacking credibility. The idea was for Plan R to be a sort of retaliatory safeguard.
A safeguard?
I admit the human element seems to have failed us here, but the idea was to discourage the Ruskies from any hope that they could knock out Washington and yourself, sir, as part of a general sneak attack and escape retaliation because of lack of proper command and control.
Well, I assume then that the planes will return automatically once they reach their fail-safe points.
Well, no, sir, I'm afraid not. You see, the planes were holding at their fail-safe points when the go code was issued. Now, once they fly beyond fail-safe, they do not require a second order to proceed. They will continue until they reach their target.
Then why haven't you radioed the planes countermanding the go code?
Well, I'm afraid we're unable to communicate with any of the aircraft.
Why?
As you may recall, sir, one of the provisions of Plan R provides that once the go code is received, the normal SSB radios in the aircraft are switched into a special coded device, which I believe is designated as CRM-114. Now, in order to prevent the enemy from issuing fake or confusing orders, CRM-114 is designed not to receive at all, unless the message is preceded by the correct three-letter code group prefix.
Then do you mean to tell me, General Turgidson, that you will be unable to recall the aircraft?
That's what science. However, we are plowing through every possible three-letter combination of the code.
But since there are 17,000 permutations, it's going to take us about 2.5 days to transmit them all.
How soon did you say the planes would penetrate Russian radar cover?
About 18 minutes from now, sir.
Are you in contact with General Ripper?
No, sir, no. General Ripper sealed off the base and cut off all communications.
Where did you get all this information?
General Ripper called Strategic Air Command headquarters shortly after he issued the go code. I have a portion of the transcript of that conversation if you'd like me to read it.
Read it.
The duty officer asked General Ripper to confirm the fact that he had issued the go code, and he said,
Yes, gentlemen, they are on their way in, and no one can bring them back. For the sake of our country and our way of life, I suggest you get the rest of SAC in after them. Otherwise, we will be totally destroyed by red retaliation. My boys will give you the best kind of start, 1,400 megatons worth, and you sure as hell won't stop them now. So let's get going. There's no other choice. God willing, we will prevail in peace and freedom from fear and in true health through the purity and essence of our natural fluids. God bless you all. And he hung up.
But the brilliance of Turgidson's characters and by extension all the generals is that, oh yeah, you know, hey, you know, we, it was a mistake that we launched the bombers, but since they're en route, we might as well go through the plan. It's a good plan. We planned it, you know? So the set of the war room itself is pretty great.
Well, and originally when Kubrick was creating this film, it was going to be a drama. And a lot of the times late at night to lighten the mood, because it was really dark when originally it was written as a drama, as you can imagine. If you can imagine if this was meant as a drama, Kubrick and the others would role play the war room participants' food orders, hence the food order scene in the beginning of the first war room sweep. You know, they would think of the most outrageous things that people would, if you were in the war room trapped with all these people, what would you order for food, you know? But Kubrick finally decided that there was too much to be taken in as a drama that you could only absorb the full force of this movie if it were done in satire. And so he pushed it into satire. And so that's what his other game was. What's the most outrageous line every character could say, but still remain credible? That's kind of what he pushed all of the dialogue into.
And I think that's one of George C. Scott's problems, is that he thought a lot of it was way too over the top.
Kubrick had George C. Scott do three lines every time he did a line. Do one drama, do one serious, and then do one over the top. And then he would tell George C. Scott, I'm not going to use the over the top one, except that every time the one in the film was the over the top one.
Well, and Stanley Kubrick has a reputation for shooting everything a million times. A million takes for every scene.
He had a bunch of ammo to use against George C. Scott that George C. Scott felt that it wasn't his best work. He goes, my over-the-top stuff isn't my best work, except that, in my opinion, his over-the-top stuff is his best work. It's the best, and probably some of the best parts of this movie.
Oh, it would not have succeeded as a comedy, as a satire-type comedy, because a lot of the other comedy in the War Room verges on slapstick, and it was going to, of course, we'll talk about the alternate ending that was going to go into complete slapstick, but George C. Scott's character, Turgidson, keeps it all very real. It's like he's very earnest, but he's also quite interested in following through on the plan, and he'll do what his orders are, but it's a good plan, and he's appalled when they start doing things like inviting the Russian ambassador to the war room.
And his disappointment and animosity is palpable.
But not... not like a disrespectful level, though.
When Kubrick had the war room created, he insisted that they paint the war room table green. And the set designer was like, it's in black and white. Why do you care that it's green? He goes, I don't care. I want it green because I want everybody to think that all these people are around this poker table gambling for the future of the world.
Oh, exactly. And that's exactly what they're doing. So it's brilliant. It's a brilliant directorial move right there. When we get to the war room, we are, Turgidson's job is to explain and brief the president, who, by the way, the president, Peter Sellers, of course, he is a little bit shocked and flabbergasted to learn that, they could declare nuclear war without him. And so Turgidson, gets to explain that, no, that's why this whole Plan R was developed, in case something happened to you.
That was the beauty of Plan R.
Exactly. What they don't know, because what Ripper didn't announce to anybody, was what code they were using with the CMR discriminator on the radio.
CRM.
Sorry, CRM. Of course, the planes are 2 hours away from their targets in the Soviet Union. And when asked how long it would take them to go through all the possible codes, he says, it'll take approximately 2 days. The president is like, that's not going to work. So he orders the army chief to storm the base and to seize Ripper. Although Turgidson points out that, in preparation for something like Plan R, he's going to be alerting his men and they're going to lock down the whole base and you're going to be hard-pressed to get into that base. And again, Turgidson at this point is still advocating to let the attack continue, because while they have the upper hand, they might as well use it.
Yeah, we're already committed. Why not?
Yeah, and they could wipe out the majority of Soviet missiles, so it would only cost a few million American lives.
I think 10% or something, he said.
Yeah. So
acceptable losses.
Yeah, so what's 20 million people? So, of course, the president says no. And so he brings in the Soviet ambassador, Alexei Desadetsky, who is played by Peter Bull, and he just does a fantastic job as the Soviet ambassador.
Yeah.
So then they have to get the premier, Dmitry Kisov, on the hotline. Now, of course, here's where the international incident could start, why they had to do the disclaimer probably, because from the moment the ambassador tells the president that the premier is probably drunk and with a girlfriend.
Which is pretty hilarious. But exactly how you hope the premier would have been.
Exactly. And, kind of, at least in my upbringing, a fairly standard portrayal of what a Russian would be. So, the ones that weren't basically Nazis were instead drunk. Anyway, so the president's solution is to tell the premier about the situation and suggest that the Soviets fire on the American planes to stop the attack, which does not make Turgidson happy at all.
No, of course not.
And of course, the Russians don't believe him anyway.
Well, why would they?
Well, exactly. So then, after this whole discussion, the ambassador explains that the Soviet Union has created a doomsday device. 50 buried bombs with cobalt thorium G set to detonate should any nuclear attack strike their country. I am going to go 90 to 100% on pronunciation tonight.
Good job.
The Soviets had conceived of... Oh, that was a joke, sorry.
I laughed.
Yeah, no. Well, can you do? The Soviets say they conceived of the system after they read a New York Times article claiming the U.S. was already working on such a device. And this is where we're introduced to the third Sellers character, the president's wheelchair-bound scientific advisor, former Nazi Dr. Strangelove.
Now, what about? Cobalt thorium G has a radioactive half-life of 93 years. If you take, say, 50 H-bombs in the 100 megaton range and jacket them with cobalt thorium G, when they are exploded, they will produce a doomsday shroud, a lethal cloud of radioactivity which will encircle the Earth for 93 years.
Oh, what a load of commie bull. I mean, after all.
Afraid I don't understand something, Alexei. Is the Premier threatening to explode this if our planes carry out their attack?
No, sir. It is not a thing a sane man would do. The doomsday machine is designed to trigger itself automatically.
But surely you can disarm it somehow?
No. It is designed to explode if any attempt is ever made to untrigger it.
Automatically?
Ah, it's an obvious commie trick, Mr. President. We're wasting valuable time. Look at the big boy. They're getting ready to clobber us.
But this is absolute madness, Ambassador. Why should you build such a thing?
There were those of us who fought against it, but in the end we could not keep up with the expense involved in the arms race, the space race, and the peace race. And at the same time, our people grumbled for more nylons and washing machines. Our doomsday scheme cost us just a small fraction of what we've been spending on defense in a single year. But the deciding factor was when we learned that your country was working along similar lines, and we were afraid of a doomsday gap.
This is preposterous. I've never approved of anything like that.
Our source was the New York Times.
Dr. Strangelove, do we have anything like that in the works?
A moment, please, Mr. President.
Under the authority granted me as Director of Weapons Research and Development, I commissioned last year a study of this project by the Bland Corporation. Based on the findings of the report, my conclusion was that this idea was not a practical deterrent for reasons which at this moment must be all too obvious.
Then you mean it is possible for them to have built such a thing?
Mr. President, the technology required is easily within the means of even the smallest nuclear power. It requires only the will to do so.
But how is it possible for this thing to be triggered automatically and at the same time impossible to untrigger?
Mr. President, it is not only possible, it is essential. That is the whole idea of this machine, you know. Deterrence is the art of producing in the mind of the enemy the fear to attack. And so, because of the automated and irrevocable decision-making process which rules out human meddling, the doomsday machine is terrifying. It's simple to understand and completely credible and convincing.
Gee, I wish we had one of them doomsday machines, Stacy.
But this is fantastic, Strangelove. How can it be triggered automatically?
Well, it's remarkably simple to do that. When you merely wish to bury bombs, there's no limit to the size. After that, they are connected to a gigantic complex of computers. Now then, a specific and clearly defined set of circumstances under which the bombs are to be exploded is programmed into a tape memory bank. A single roll of
Strangler
can store all the information.
What kind of a name is that? That ain't no crowd name, is it, Stanley? He changed it when he became a citizen. It used to be McVictor Lieber. A crowd by any other name, I think.
Is that the whole point of the Doomsday Machine is lost? If you keep it a secret, why didn't you tell the world, eh?
It was to be announced at the party congress on Monday. As you know, the premier loves surprises.
Just the imagery of him in the wheelchair, wheeling around, fighting himself against the leather glove is just comic gold.
And again, this is, you know, right now, you know, anybody who didn't grow up during the Cold War or remember what happened after World War II with Operation Paperclip and, oh, I don't know, heroes like Wernher von Braun.
Exactly.
You know, who was a Nazi and then, you know, because he was useful, came over to our side. But, yeah, so.
And was very, very, very richly rewarded for doing so.
Well, and as Tom Lehrer pointed out.
Gather round while I sing you of Wernher von Braun, a man whose allegiance is ruled by expedience. Call him a Nazi, he won't even frown. Nazi schmatzi, says Wernher von Braun. Don't say that he's hypocritical. Say rather that he's apolitical. Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, says Wernher von Braun. Some have harsh words for this man of renown, but some think our attitude should be one of gratitude, like the widows and cripples in old London town, who owe their large pensions to Wernher von Braun. You too may be a big hero, once you've learned to count backwards to zero. In German or English, I know how to count down. And I'm learning Chinese, says Wernher von Braun.
So at this point in the game, army forces arrive at Burbelsen. But of course, as predicted, the base's troops are guarding it, and they see these clearly army vehicles, or U.S. military vehicles coming, and their only comment to each other is, damn, those commies are good at disguise. So they open...
Never for a moment questioning the fact that maybe they've been sold a bill of goods.
Oh, no, not at all. Nobody questions. Yeah, it's not in their interest to question. Which actually is sort of the military way.
It is.
You know, I mean, that's how it works. If everybody, you know, you have to trust in your civilian leadership. And if you can't do as you're told, you shouldn't be in the military.
Right. It's all about chain of command.
Yeah. So
you don't break the chain.
Well, and you're not supposed to think for yourself. It's a little like being a Catholic. They, of course, open fire on the military forces. And during this whole thing, of course, Ripper has now completely lost it. And Mandrake is looking for ways to, I don't know, maybe shoot Ripper and kill him. But as it turns out, he doesn't have to, because as his final act, Ripper goes into the bathroom and kills himself. Now, at this point, Colonel Bat Guano confronts Mandrake, and they have a little standoff because Colonel Guano believes that Mandrake isn't the enemy. So they have a little exchange. And then, of course, they involve the shooting of the Coke machine in order to make the call.
Yeah, so he doesn't have enough change to make the long-distance phone call to the White House, even station to station. So he orders Bat Guano to shoot the Coca-Cola machine to get change from him, at which point his retort is like,
Oh, blast. I'm still trying to send short. Operator, hold on one. I shan't keep you a second. Colonel, that Coca-Cola machine, I want you to shoot the lock off it. There may be some change in there.
That's private property.
Colonel, can you possibly imagine what is going to happen to you, your frame outlook, way of life and everything, when they learn that you have obstructed a telephone call to the President of the United States? Can you imagine? Shoot it off! Shoot with a gun! That's what the bullets are for, you twit!
Okay. I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
Which is hysterical.
Right, because, like, you know, you're not worried about the whole end of the world or anything. Like, you didn't have to shoot your way through other soldiers to get to this point in the base, but you're worried about the Coca-Cola company.
Oh, yeah, because make no mistake, people have died in this movie already.
Yeah.
I mean, potentially a great many people have died.
Yeah.
Although, as it turns out... anyway, we'll get there. So, unfortunately, things in the sky, there's a great deal of business where on the plane, Slim Pickens is going through the both the orders for Plan R and also the equipment that you're assigned during Plan R. And he's going through them and describing the contents. He said that, you could have a great night in, and what city did he say?
Vegas.
Yes. And why did he say Vegas?
Because originally the script was I was going to have a great night in Houston, except the movie release.
No. Hold on. Dallas.
Yes, Dallas, because, of course, the movie release date was going to be very close to November 22nd, 1964, which was, of course, the day that Kennedy was shot. So, in Dallas, Texas.
Yeah. Bad timing. And that changed a couple of things in the movie, including the actual entire end of the movie.
Yeah. Well, and it did. I mean, and they pushed the release date back into January. Even though Kubrick was like, he wanted to get it in for the Oscars.
Yeah. Hold on just a second. I got to do a little bit of fact checking here. Yeah. It's 11/23 of 63. I think you said 11/20. Yeah. 11/23 of 64 is what you said.
Well, I thought 11/22 because 11/23.
I'm sorry. It's 11/22/63. But right. I think you said 64 because it was released in January of 64. When it was released in 64? You said they wanted to get into January, but they didn't.
We wanted to release in November, because it would be fresh in the Oscars' mind. But it ended up going in January, which means it wasn't eligible till the next year.
Again, you can't have a fun night in Dallas and in November, late November at least of 63.
Yeah, that would have ended poorly.
Yeah, well, just disrespectful generally. And since this is a farce, but it's like very sensitive time in American history as well. Especially since people were highly suspicious of Soviet involvement in the assassination of our president.
Well, there's that too.
The war room has already told the Soviets, to knock down their planes and gave all the coordinates for the airplanes and all their flight paths to the Soviets so that they can use their defenses to knock out all the planes. And just before the end, Mandrake was able to get the CRM code to the war room so that they could actually call off the attack.
And he figured out which of the codes could have been left from Ripper because he kind of was brainstorming them in the office.
Yeah, and his code is some sort of version of OPE, which is purity of essence. Your precious bodily fluids and whatnot.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a commie drink anything but vodka, ever? Like, how absurd.
No.
That's why I only drink distilled water or rainwater. So, of course, hey, they called off all the bombers. It's fine. Except, of course, that the crew, King Kong's crew, had narrowly averted being shot down by a surface-to-air missile, and it knocked out their radio. So they don't actually have a radio to receive the signal to go back. And they find out that even though three of the planes have been shot down by the Soviets, there still is this one unaccounted for plane. And so the president tells the Soviets where the targets are so that they can easily find the plane. But because that their aircraft has been damaged in the missile attack, they have to change their target. So, of course, the plane is en route, and everybody in the war room is sort of a hushed silence because they know what's going to happen. They hope it won't happen, but they do believe that World War III is about to begin. So on board the plane, we have this other drama because they have their target selected, and the bomb doors will not open. So what do they do to alleviate that? Major Kong climbs on a bomb, adjusts the wiring, and as the doors open, Kong actually is straddling the bomb to get the doors to open. So when the missiles launch, he's riding it like a rodeo cowboy, and he waves his cowboy hat as it falls.
Yeah, and I actually equated to he was basically orgasming to the impact.
Yeah. So at this point, we have the bombs are dropping on the Soviets. So, let's see, now they're talking about, well, okay, we know this is going to trigger the doomsday device, so what do we do? So Dr. Strangelove, because Sadisky has mentioned that within 10 months of the activation of the doomsday device, the entire surface of the Earth will be uninhabitable. But Dr. Strangelove recommends that the president gather several hundred thousand people with a high female-to-male ratio, which pleases Turgidson to no end, to live in deep mine shafts in order to escape the radiation, and then to do a breeding program that will allow you to repopulate the surface after 100 years have passed. But then, of course, Turgidson warns that, well, hold on, if we're doing this thing, then the Russians are probably doing this thing, and there might be a mine shaft gap.
Which is just hilarious, because you can totally see how quickly our government goes off the rails, because you can see it in action in this movie.
Well, and you're going to take this whole Cold War mentality right to the end.
Right.
You know, you're going to keep doing it. So Dr. Strangelove then shouts that he has a plan, and he gets up from his wheelchair.
We emerge! Mr. President, we must not allow a mine shaft gap!
Sir, I have a plan. Monsieur, I can walk!
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
And he shouts, "Mein Führer, I can walk." And then they cut to an entire montage of actual footage of nuclear detonations.
Mushroom clouds.
Yeah, accompanied by We'll Meet Again, which is really kind of a haunting ending. I mean, the end of this movie is the end of the world.
Yeah.
Which I, of course, fully approve of as a horror fan. But, yeah, so this is a dark movie, and even though it's a satire and it's hilarious in parts, it ends badly.
Well, but you can also see why Kubrick decided to make it a satire and not a full drama, because I can easily understand how this would have just been an impossible movie to sit through.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Drew and I are going to talk a little bit later tonight about a movie that ratchets up the tension and never gives you release. This is not something we want in a movie, as it turns out.
Okay. Yeah, that would seem frustrating.
No, the movie's called Take Shelter, and it is the single most depressing movie I've ever seen in my entire life.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Yeah. I will avoid that one.
I would rather watch The Road and Dear Zachary in a row then watch that movie
again. You're a bad man. You're a bad man.
You'll have to trust me on this. Take Shelter is the doomsday device of depressing movies.
Well, a couple more things before we close out Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, no, no. Hold on. You have notes. So can you tell us about the alternate ending?
Well, so they had a huge cream pie fight slated to happen in the war room, and the thinking was that it was going to simulate the missiles hitting the ground, and there was going to be a montage comparing the pie strikes to missile strikes, because that, you know, it wasn't obvious enough what was going on, except that it very quickly got out of hand, and you couldn't make out any of the actors amongst all of the cream pie. And so everybody became unrecognizable, and so it was not usable as far as Kubrick, you know, he's like, there's no way to edit this into the movie. And so it ended up being dropped. Plus, they cut up so much, it was so hilarious, that there was no dialogue that they could have had or used.
And I heard there was another part of the pie fight that made it unusable, and that was the fact that one of the jokes was that, Merkin Muffley gets hit with the pie in the head and he falls down, and one of the people say, "Oh my God, the president's been grievously wounded."
Oh dear.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that was left out of the commentary.
Exactly. So.
Yeah. And then, there was a part in the movie where Peter Sellers is on the couch and Ripper's trying to get him to come help him shoot against the intruders on the base.
Patrick, come here.
You calling me, Jack?
Just come over here and help me with this belt.
I haven't had very much experience, you know, with those sort of machines, Jack. I only ever pressed a button in my old Spitfire.
Hendrick, in the name of Her Majesty and the Continental Congress, come here and feed me this belt, boy.
Jack, I'd love to come. But what's happened, you see, the string in my leg's gone.
The what?
And the string. I never told you, but you see, I've got a gammy leg. Oh, dear. Gone, shot off.
Mandrake, come over here. The redcoats are coming. Come on.
The original line was, there's a thing in my leg that went up, but Sellers flubbed it, except that he sold it so convincingly that they kept the line in, even though they immediately cut after because they were all laughing too hard on set.
Well, I wondered about the string in his leg. I thought, what? I don't understand, but this is a crazy movie anyway, so I don't understand.
It was an ad-libbed flub, but it was hilarious, so they kept it in.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
And in the shots outside where they're, you see the footage of the infantrymen shooting at the building on base, where they're kind of, you know, they're right in front of the buildings, and they're like, you see the Jeep parked up front, and the guy's crawling through the grass.
Yes.
On their bellies, trying to, you know, with the... So one of those guys in his belly is Kubrick with a 16mm camera getting footage. Two of them actually went out and got footage on the soundstage that they used because he wanted realistic, actual footage. And so what you're seeing was footage, live footage taken from their firefight from Kubrick and one of the assistants. I thought that was pretty interesting. The only other note I have is that, after Reagan saw this movie, he asked his staff where the war room was, and the staff had to break it to him that, well, there really was no war room in the White House.
You know, God.
There's a situation room, but there's no war room.
Oh, that's funny. With the big maps and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly. And also, so apparently at one point also the set designer and Kubrick were visited by the CIA because they were not granted any access to the bombers from the U.S. government, so they had to make it up. But apparently their information was so accurate in some of what they created, the government was worried that it was too close and it was going to be giving the enemies, you know, pictures of what the inside of our cockpits looked like.
Which is incredible. I mean,
yeah.
Set design is important.
And then apparently they chartered a plane. So all of the footage that you see of the bomber superimposed over those, you know, the icebergs and the water and the ocean and all of that sweeping footage you saw, they actually went and created. They actually flew a plane around Iceland and Greenland and around the North Pole, and they went all around with a plane with marked on the side Dr. Strangelove, and they shot, you know, just hours and hours and hours and hours of footage. However, they accidentally came upon a secret U.S. base and were forced to land and interrogated. They were held by the U.S. base, and all their film footage was confiscated and viewed. Because they were worried that perhaps they might give something away. Eventually, they were returned, but they were the base was worried that they were like Soviet spies, and they weren't sure because the side of the plane was Dr. Strangelove.
That's funny. Well, that's at first I was going to say that's the one flaw in this movie is that the special effects don't hold up, but the fact that A, it's in black and white, and B, it's a farce means that it actually, it's just in the character of the movie to have sort of cheesy effects when it comes to the plane itself.
Yeah, the plane itself was absolutely cheesy, but there was little they could do with that. But the footage, all the footage you see, if you're looking through the cockpit, it's like they had three different, they had to have three different backdrops going because they had to play one through one side of the plane's windows and one through the other side of the plane's windows. And so there was a lot of footage that they kind of, rigged around with to kind of get that going, which is kind of incredible for, the early 60s, because you realize there wasn't technology that did this.
Well, and, the inside of the plane was actually great. It wasn't cheesy at all. Really got the feel of the confined space. Although one of the funnier moments I thought was when, he's talking on the radio between James Earl Jones and those characters, the Bombardier and whatever the other flight people are, and the captain. And he's like, I'll just have to come back there. And you realize all he has to do is turn around and like walk three steps.
Exactly. I know. He just gets up and goes back there, yeah. Like 10 feet, maybe.
Which is hysterical.
Hilarious.
Now, this, while I was looking about the making of the movie, the whole Columbia Pictures agreed to finance the film on the condition that Peter Sellers play at least four major roles. And that was because the studio was really impressed with Kubrick's previous film, Lolita, where Sellers plays, his character assumes several identities. Well, looking at Lolita, I didn't realize, because I've never seen the original Lolita, as it turns out. I've seen the Jeremy Irons version, which is not a comedy. And evidently, Lolita itself is something of a dark comedy. So I'm going to have to invest a little time in that.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either. Now it's on my list because I need to see it now because there was a preview for it in the extras on my DVD.
Well, and, Frank Langella plays the Claire Quimby character that Peter Sellers plays. And I don't remember that being funny in the least bit, but we'll see how it works out.
I can't even imagine.
Well, and of course, Jeremy Irons is so creepy. I mean, Jeremy Irons plays a good Humbert because he's just so damn creepy.
I love Jeremy Irons, though. I really do. I think my favorite Jeremy Irons movie is Reversal of Fortune.
Oh, yeah. That's a great. We'll have to do that sometime. It's a great movie. The only thing I like better than Jeremy Irons is when Greg Proops does his Jeremy Irons impression.
Yes. I agree.
It's hysterical.
Do you listen to the Smartest Man in the World?
Yeah, I don't listen to every single one, but I do quite like it.
Yeah, no, I absolutely love his Jeremy Irons, so I agree with you.
Yeah, that Proops guy, he is hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so what else do we have with the Dr. Strangelove facts?
No, that was pretty much all of them. I was going through my notes. We pretty much covered all of them.
Okay, here, by the way, back to the Merkin. Merkin is actually a pubic hair wig. So since the president is bald and his last name is Muffley, they're doing an homage to the Merkin.
Oh, my gosh.
But again, just goofy, goofy fun.
I imagine that's pretty risque for the 60s, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, plus it's probably kind of an inside joke, too.
Well, yeah, because I'm like, I wouldn't have got it. So I wonder how many people would have got it. But I bet all the artsy fartsy smart film guys who watched this film just laughed themselves stupid.
Well, yeah, all the theater people knew what a Merkin was, so you know. Yeah, I like the fact that James Earl Jones talks about how Slim Pickens, he was Major Kong on and off the set. It's because, of course, he was just himself.
Exactly.
And actually, he wasn't told the movie was a comedy. He was just told to play it straight. So, you know.
And he did.
And really, except for the very end where he, like, does the wahoo as he's, you know, going down on the, or he's not going down on the missile. He's riding the missile. Actually, even riding the missile sounds bad. So, yeah, because other than that, he plays it all really straight. But yeah,
I think everybody on the plane played it straight.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, you know, even in the war room, everybody is playing, you know, that's what makes it all succeed. That's what makes the comedy succeed, is that everybody is taking their part very seriously.
And I think the funniest part of this whole movie, though, is when George C. Scott is, you know, is Turgidson. The president asks him, well, can the pilot land the plane? And, you know, he describes, oh, you know, I've seen these guys who be able to take these planes and land them. And he does the whole gyration and he shows, you know, he is a plane. His arms are out to his sides and he's making the plane come in for a landing motion. That is seriously one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Oh, and, you know, again, this sounds kind of hacky now, but it still, it made me laugh out loud when, you know, Turgidson and Sadisky are in a physical fight and the president's like, gentlemen, stop it. There's no fighting in the war room.
Exactly.
I mean, you know.
It's irony abound.
It's just classic. It's just classic stuff. I'm super happy that we had the opportunity to watch this movie and talk about it, because it's definitely one of my favorite all-time movies.
Yeah, I think, and it's on the top of a great many lists of, you know, films, top 100, you know, that I think AFI listed as number 2 or number 3. But, you know, I was thinking to myself, really, you know, with the lack of the Cold War tension, though, how many people in another generation, you know, my nieces, are they going to understand this movie if they see it?
That's a good question. Probably not.
Because it wouldn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't, you know, because they didn't grow up with the Cold War and the hysteria and, you know, Stalin and, you know, then the subsequent, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis. And not that I was around for the Cuban Missile Crisis, but I'm saying, you know, the build up, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Cold War, you know, the you know, the day after, all of that, that all fed into the, you know, the mass paranoia that we all kind of collectively felt as a country and probably as a world, you know, not knowing what was going to happen.
Well, and, you know, you and I were not alive during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but our mother and grandparents were living in Alaska where,
right,
you know, within a 10-minute drive were Nike missile silos ready to launch their missiles against the Soviets. And, by the way, making Anchorage a target as well.
Well, and I think I was talking to Travis, but I might have been talking to somebody else. You know, growing up in Alaska, where I knew very early on that Alaska was first strike. Like, if there was a nuclear war, Alaska would first strike. And I remember arguing with one of my friends in elementary school, of all things, because he was like, no, you know, because of the movie The Day After came out. He's like, no, that's why The Day After came out. It was the first strike going to be the Midwest. I'm like, that doesn't make sense, you idiot. Alaska's going to be the first strike. Why would they strike the Midwest when they knew that Alaska had missiles and was going to strike them within, you know, the first, you know, that's going to be the first volley of Alaska.
Well, and was, just I mean, from
actually,
a...
It ended up making him cry, so.
That's my brother.
I know. I'm like, oh, that's my talent.
I mean, just from a logistical standpoint, you know, you launch a bunch of missiles and the one aiming at Alaska gets there first. In fact, right, with this whole nuclear North Korea, the only reason I think that Alaska shouldn't be as scared as, say, Hawaii is because even though it's, I'm not sure the distances, they're probably fairly equidistant as far as to get to a major populated area in Alaska. Luckily, there are basically only one, and I'm living in it, so that kind of sucks. But the advantage from the North Koreans' perspective, is if they launch on Hawaii, it's about the same distance, and they can kill a lot of Japanese also, which, you know, is helpful.
Works out for them.
Yeah, exactly. Historically, it works out just fine.
So, yeah, no, I mean, I remember talking to Travis about, you know, because he and I watched The Day After at a friend's house a couple of years ago, because he'd never seen it. And, you know, it's a fairly disturbing movie. And it's, of course, it's pretty depressing, of course. But, you know, I don't think he quite felt the gravity of it that I still do. And I was like, well, my family grew up when this constant shadow of fear, whether or not, you know, I didn't quake every night when I went to bed, but it was always definitely in the back of my head that, you know, I might not live, you know, very long.
Well, and, you know, they had provisions, like, you know, our mom talks about the hardtack they had stuck away, not, as it turns out, for the massive earthquake they lived through in 1964, but the Cuban Missile Crisis a couple of years earlier.
Right. And people were turned out.
Yeah. I mean, people were prepared be killed in an amazing war. I mean, an apocalyptic conflagration, if you will.
Oh, that was nice linguistically. Good job.
Yeah, I can't say nuclear, but I can nail conflagration.
Well, very good. You know, we all have our crosses to bear.
Yeah, it's, do you smell toast? Anyway, so yeah.
So back to this. You maligned the road, by the way. You maligned the road and Dear Zachary, which I will never forgive you for.
I maligned it because they're both very depressing movies.
Well, I don't know that the road is. I don't know. I didn't think the road was depressing. I thought it was kind of sad, but I thought it was a great story.
I'm going to have to revisit it, but not this month, because I've had my share of...
No. Definitely The Road is a movie. I have the audiobook version of The Road, and I actually listened to that before I saw the movie. And the movie is pretty close to the book, but both the book and the movie... My problem with the book and the movie both is that I couldn't get it out of my head in the beginning, that there's no specific cause of the calamity that causes the destruction of society and the planet and everything. That's what I had the problem with, is that you just have this supposition that you don't know what happens, but something apocalyptic, but you don't know what. And that drives me crazy. That kind of stuff drives me crazy. Because those details, I'm like, I want to know what happened. But you never know, either in the book or the movie. But the movie is almost verbatim to the book, and so obviously there's some things that are omitted for time's sake, but it's a fantastic movie, and it is a fantastic book, but it's definitely not something you want to watch or read when you're not having a good time, because it's a downer. And Dear Zachary, just that will be the Eric equivalent of Hair.
Oh no. Because there are happy moments in Dear Zachary. There are funny moments in Dear Zachary.
There are happy and funny moments in the movie Hair.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Are you kidding? I'd watch Hair twice in a row. I'd watch Hair and just A-B loop the entire ending over and over and over rather than watch Take Shelter one more time.
Okay. I will not take that from you. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Even still.
Well, and again, I mean, you'll hear the podcast, but Take Shelter was a well-made movie, and it was definitely, it was absolutely well-acted movie. It just was, yeah, you'll hear. I don't want to give too much away. Okay. Except that after I watched it, I immediately went to all of my coworkers that I could over 3 days of working, because everybody has different days off, so it's all staggered. So I had a new group of people to annoy every day.
I'm like, you had a new group of victims.
Yeah, and so every day I'm like, hey, have you seen this movie, Take Shelter? I'm like, no, we've seen the ad, or we saw the cover of it on Redbox, and it looked intriguing. I'm like, I want to talk to somebody else who's seen it, because I think this was one of the most depressing movies I've ever seen in my life. And maybe it's because I had sort of a rough week in parenting land, but let me tell you, I know why Robin Williams went and got the belt and went to the closet. He watched.
Oh dear.
He watched Take Shelter. Anyway, maybe not. Maybe that's be a little dramatic.
Yeah, that may be too soon.
Yeah.
I'll let it go.
Yeah. Well, it's okay. I'll probably edit it out. Every time I say, "Oh, I'll just take that out," and I never take it out, it makes me laugh. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.